Okay, any questions on details? Okay. It's hard to believe that we have just a couple weeks left of class. It's harder for me to believe, as I noted before, that I have just a couple weeks left of teaching. This is the last semester that I actually formally teach any courses, so that's... If I sound a bit nostalgic at points, you know the reason why. We're at a very interesting part of the course. The whole question of animal welfare, animal rights, is an extremely interesting and in some ways difficult issue for a liberal democratic society to deal with, liberal in the classical sense. Indeed, this Thursday, Dr. Jim Tantillo, who did his work with me on the ethics of sport hunting, will be our guest lecturer on Thursday, and will be suggesting some of the kinds of problems ethically. I want to talk a little bit more about some of the political problems we face in dealing with an issue like animal rights, animal welfare. And one of the major reasons it constitutes a problem is that traditional liberalism has argued that the state ought not to intervene unnecessarily in our lives except to prevent you from harming other people. The state, in a liberal polity, ought not to talk much about the good. It ought to confine its talk to discussions of the right, justice, how you can keep from harming other people. I think it's already evident that I have some very serious philosophical questions about this kind of position, and I'm not sure that we have followed it all that consistently. In fact, I'm rather sure we haven't. But it remains a fairly fundamental tenet of liberalism that the state is very much like the traffic cop at a busy intersection. I may have used this illustration before. The cop doesn't tell you to go to the opera and you to go to the beach, Rob, for vacation, and you to go visit the museum, and you to come to Cornell, and so on. That's not the cop's business. The cop simply keeps you from bumping into each other, keeps the flow of traffic reasonably smooth. And that's consistent with a classical liberal view of the state. Now, one of the problems, of course, with animal welfare, animal rights, is precisely that animals are not humans. And all the classical theories deal with humans. So how do you factor animals into this kind of equation? It's also a very difficult issue within a liberal polity to deal with questions like intergenerational justice or with questions such as wilderness preservation. Preserving wilderness, on the surface at least, seems to have less to do with preventing harm than it does with establishing something that makes life good. It doesn't easily fit into the harm framework, and intergenerational justice doesn't easily fit in. Let me ask you just a couple questions about that to illustrate this. I draw here on the work of a number of philosophers who have raised this issue, and the question would be something like this. If we have two scenarios, one the conservation scenario and one the pollution scenario. This particular illustration is used by, was presented by Derek Parfit, the philosopher. If we have these two scenarios, and under the conservation scenario, you do all the right things, you properly dispose of nuclear waste, perhaps you don't make any in the first place, you take care of the soil, you preserve the land and so on. And under the pollution scenario, you do all the wrong things. You just beat up on nature and just make one awful mess out of it. If we, as a society today and the foreseeable future, follow the pollution scenario, could people who live 100 years from now say that we had acted unjustly or that we had violated their rights? What do you think? How many of you think they could say that with some reasonable conviction, that we had violated their rights and acted unjustly? How many think you could not say that? A couple. How come? Pardon?
Because they're dead.
We're dead, but... Okay. Okay. Yes?
Well, it would matter. It would depend on if they polluted knowingly.
Okay, let's say for the thought experiment they polluted knowingly. Derek Parfit has a fairly straightforward answer to this. He says that they could not claim that we violated their rights. And the reason is fairly straightforward. It's actually a reason that was developed in cases of wrongful paternity. Could children sue their parents, say a child with a serious birth defect, because the parents knew that there was some chance of the child being born with this birth defect? Could children turn around and sue their parents for this? And generally the courts have, in fact, I think in almost every case they've said no. Parfit's argument is something like this, that if we had done what the people 100 years from now think we should have done, that is, if we had followed the conservation scenario, this would have had a very, very curious and somewhat counterintuitive effect. Had we followed the conservation scenario, within 100 years, we would have virtually a totally different set of people living than had we followed the pollution scenario, because it would have had very subtle effects on how you lived. You rode your bicycle more, you spent more energy gardening, you kept the house warmer in summer, cooler in the winter. You did all kinds of things like this, which would have had an effect on the exact moment at which egg and sperm join in conception. A significant effect, and this is almost universally accepted among biologists and medical people, which means that over a substantial period of time like that, a totally different set of people would be alive than would have been alive had we followed the pollution scenario. So unless they could say that their lives were so awful that it would have been better for them not to have been born at all, they can't seriously claim that we violated their rights, because had we done what they think we ought to have done, they would not have existed at all. What do you think of that argument? What?
It's really weird.
I think the argument is correct, but I don't think you should draw the wrong conclusions from it. What Parfit is showing is that a rights framework can't do everything for us. A rights framework is limited in what it can do in solving a problem like this because of very strange situations like that. How do you extend rights based on autonomous individual selves into the indefinite future? I should add just parenthetically, for instance, that other traditions that focus on virtue ethics or that focus on integrity and character, an Aristotelian position, or say a typical or traditional Jewish or Christian position would not have too much problem with that issue because of the fact that there are things within that tradition which extend through time. Obviously, in a theistic tradition, God is the God of future people as well as past people. And if God loves future people as well as present and past people, then that has certain implications for how people act and so on. So that's a fairly easy problem to solve within that tradition. But interestingly, not so easy within a rights framework. Now, don't draw the wrong conclusion for that. I believe most of us think we do have responsibilities, there may be a few exceptions, to future people, or responsibilities with respect to future people. That would perhaps be a more accurate way of phrasing it. But it's not simple to argue it on the basis of a traditional concept of rights. Now, let's get back to animals. The problem with animals, pure and simple, in terms of the Western liberal tradition, is that they're not people. And so how do you extend rights in a convincing way to animals? Well, what you will see that is really quite interesting, I think, in the readings this week from Singer and Tom Regan, is that they propose a way to do that. They propose a way to argue, they argue that you can make a convincing case that animals deserve equal consideration with humans, a la Singer, or that animals, they're both talking about sentient animals, animals that, as Regan says, are the experiencing subjects of a life, or as Singer says, animals who suffer, who feel pain, and so on. In both cases, they make a fairly interesting argument. And the argument is based on observations that they make about civil rights movement, about sexism, racism, and so on. And it goes something like this, that if you based your belief that it is just or right to treat Asians, whites, blacks, Native Americans, and so on equally or give them equal consideration, if you base that on actual equality, you would be in trouble because the scientific evidence shows that people aren't actually equal. Maasai warriors tend to be very tall. Pygmies tend to be very short. Inuit have adopted over the centuries, it seems, to be a little more compact, seems to work well in the climate. Kenyans are outstanding at marathons. West Africans are great in sprints, and on and on. These all kinds of differences among people. Certain diseases, sickle cell anemia and other things, are tied up with particular groups. There's all kinds of evidence for empirical differences, not just among individuals, but also among ethnic groups, races, and so on. So Singer says you don't want to base your position on racism or sexism and so on actual empirical equality. 30 years ago, this was fairly common. In talking about men and women, many of the feminists argued that apart from obvious differences in plumbing, men and women were clones of each other, were basically the same. And that position becomes more and more incredible today based on just reams and reams of scientific data about how people think, how their emotions work, and a whole range of issues like this that would make it very, very precarious to argue an equality case on the basis of actual physical, emotional, intellectual equality. Men and women seem to be very, very different in various respects. So Singer, and in a somewhat different way, Regan, both argue that the case for equality in among the sexes and between the sexes and civil rights and so on is not based on empirical actual equality. It is what they call a moral idea or a moral ideal. This is simply something very, very basic in Western culture. It is an idea that has great power and great influence. And then they argue that, and I'm compacting the two positions somewhat. They differ in detail because Singer is a utilitarian and Regan is a rights-based thinker. Then they argue that the problem is how can you justify not extending equality to sentient animals because you have these cases where, for instance, a smart pig, Singer says, may in most measurable respects be smarter, more able than a severely brain-damaged human. So you hear, why don't you extend this ideal of equality, this idea of equality, to animals? The only reason it seems like we don't extend it to animals, they argue, is that we're speciesists. It's not a term that Singer invented. I forget who was the first person to use the term. But we don't extend it just because we have an unjustifiable bias towards our own species. And therefore, if we were thinking clearly, if we were reasonable, we would extend this sense of equality to animals or well. And they use sometimes very, very strong language for making this kind of move. Regan says, shall we claim that only humans belong to the right species, the species Homo sapiens? But this is blatant speciesism. He says, will it be said then that all and only humans have immortal souls? Then our opponents have their work cut out for them, and so on. He says, well, perhaps some will say that animals have some inherent value, only less than we have. Once again, however, attempts to defend this view can be shown to lack rational justification. I want you to pay particular attention to terms like that. What could be the basis of our having more inherent value than animals? And he concludes this discussion with the comment, all who have inherent value have it equally. That's Tom Regan. Singer's arguments are actually very, very similar. He argues that there just is not a rational basis for limiting equal consideration to just to humans. He says, for instance, on page 18, the life of every human being is sacred. Some people hold this, many people. Yet people who would say this about the infant do not object to the killing of non-human animals. How can they justify their different judgments? Adult chimpanzees, dogs, pigs, and members of many other species far surpass the brain-damaged infant in their ability to relate to others, act independently, be self-aware, and any other capacity that could reasonably be said to give value to life. Now, again, notice the term reasonable, rational, and so on. Now, what do we make out of arguments like that? Are they rationally compelling? Do they convince you? Is it a sound argument? What do we make out of them? Let me just get a little feedback on it, and then I want to extend this further. Yes, Colleen.
Why does Regan say that all who have inherent value have an equal?
Well, because he draws this from the way we relate to humans. It's very widespread in Western culture to believe that because you have an IQ of 70, you're not inherently deserving of less consideration, fewer rights, and so on than if you have an IQ of 130. Because you're an Olympic athlete, you aren't inherently more valuable than someone who's severely handicapped. So he draws that, and he wants to extend that to animals. Okay. Other, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, Singer argues that since the baby right after birth is not a person, he argues in some cases that the parents ought to have 6 months or so to decide whether to keep the baby, and if the baby's too much trouble or if they don't like the way the baby turned out, they should be able to kill the baby. And that's not as absurd as it seems. because look at the recent position Democrats have taken on partial birth abortion, which their position was you should be able to kill the baby or fetus in utero right up to the moment of birth. And certainly that's a very, very difficult position to maintain unless you argue some doctrine of personhood. So Singer is actually not that far from the position the majority of Democrats have taken on partial birth abortion. Why should you be able to puncture the skull and suck the brains out 5 minutes before full-term birth, but not be able to kill the baby 2 hours or 2 months after birth because the baby's too much trouble? If the baby is too much trouble 10 minutes before birth and you kill the baby with the blessing of the state, why limit it to that? Why not give parents a little more time to think it over? What do you do? I don't want to focus on that issue, but so your point, Scott, is relevant. It's a tough issue. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It ignores that it really seems like what the issue is all about. That's like the fact that humans have some kind of spirit, and it never really gets into that at all.
Okay, both Singer and Regan get into that, and basically reject it. There's a very interesting footnote that I'm not sure if I reproduced it for the packet. If I didn't, I need to hand that out to you. He says in footnote 14 to the first chapter, he says, I am here putting aside religious views, for example, the doctrine that all and only human beings have immortal souls or are made in the image of God. Historically, these have been very important and no doubt are partly responsible for the idea that human life has a special sanctity. Logically, however, these religious views are unsatisfactory since they do not offer a reasoned explanation of why it should be that all humans and no non-humans have immortal souls. This belief, too, therefore, comes under suspicion as a form of speciesism. In any case, defenders of the sanctity of life view are generally reluctant to base their position on purely religious doctrines, since these doctrines are no longer as widely accepted as they once were. So they're aware of this, but they don't buy it. Now, what do you say about their conclusions, Shannon?
Mm-hmm. Aren't religious, basically.
Okay.
Some people that are religious are going to be like, oh, well, how can you just reject that? Well, to people reading that book, that might already be like, well, duh. Like, that's an obvious starting point.
Okay.
So, for people who already believe in that, I think his arguments are much stronger than for people who are.
Okay. Okay. Now, why? They talk about rational justification and the only reasonable position. Why is it reasonable for Singer and Reagan to believe in equal inherent value? One of the most obvious things, it would seem, is that people aren't of equal value. And most cultures throughout human history have not thought of people as being of equal value. Women weren't as valuable as men in many cultures. Slaves were obviously inferior and not as valuable. Foreigners, people from other tribes and nations, weren't as valuable. So why is it now more rational for them to think of all humans as possessing equal inherent value, or for Singer as all humans deserving equal consideration? Doesn't that seem like an odd move? What do you think? Some of you haven't spoken. Is that a rational move? Okay, it's a tough, tough, tough issue. What I would argue is something like this. I have been deeply affected by Singer's work, the whole middle part of his book where he gives examples of maltreatment of animals, I think has had a very strong influence on contemporary culture, and much of it very positive. I think some of the examples he gives of veal calves and so on are very, very persuasive. I believe his logical arguments, and the same would apply to Regan, I think fail, and for the following reason. The major reason historically why the idea of equality developed in the West, and it is mainly a Western idea except by importation, it developed clearly in the West, is that it grew out of, mainly, there are other contributing factors from Greek philosophy, but the main source was the Jewish idea of human beings created in the image of God, an idea later adopted by Christians, which goes back to your comment about soul or spirit and so on. Jews believed, and Christians adopted this, and Muslims have adopted this, that human beings are created in the image of God. They are a special part of creation, and that they share this equally. So that the person who has an IQ of 70 or 170, who is handicapped or an Olympic athlete, all equally in share in this reality of having an eternal spirit or soul or being created in the image of God. Now, what is extremely interesting is that both Singer and Regan want to keep the equality idea, but they want to jettison the foundation of it, why it was picked up and accepted as rational and believable in the Western world, but not in most other parts of the world. Now, I don't think that that's a totally wrong thing to do. What I think is totally wrong is their argument that this is the only rational way to look at the issue. I think they're really pulling the wool over our eyes by again and again suggesting that they're being rational, they're being reasonable, they are logical, but these Christians now and these Jews over here and others who believe that humans have a special worth because, say, they were created in the image of God, they're not being rational. And that, it seems to me, is just fundamentally odd. And this grows in part out of some very interesting things that Singer particularly says about the nature of religion. Singer is very much what I would call a religionist, in after the sense of sexist or racist. He has some very, very odd views, it seems to me, about how religion and theology function. Let me share just a couple of these passages. I'm having a hard time finding the exact passage I want here, but let me try to find this. Just a sec. Here we go. He says on page 206, only those who prefer religious faith to beliefs based on reasoning and evidence can still maintain that the human species is the special darling of the entire universe, or that other animals were created to provide us with food, or that we have divine authority over them and divine permission to kill them. Now, that's a very odd statement. Only those who prefer religious faith to beliefs based on reasoning and evidence, but the fundamental reason he gives in his whole argument is not based on reason and evidence. It's just an assumption. And he even undercuts the foundation for why the assumption was originally made. That is, that all humans have equal inherent value. He gives us no reason for that. It's an assumption that functions philosophically, theologically, very much like the views of the people he's criticizing. On the previous page, 205, once the weight of scientific evidence in favor of the theory of evolution became apparent, practically every earlier justification of our supreme place in creation and our dominion over the animals had to be reconsidered. Intellectually, the Darwinian revolution was genuinely revolutionary. Human beings now knew that they were not the special creation of God, made in the divine image and set apart from the animals. On the contrary, human beings came to realize that they were animals themselves. That's just BS. How could he possibly know that? Science can't possibly answer that kind of question. I think some form of Darwinism is the best theory we have for talking about human development and so on. But scientists cannot address the question whether humans have greater value. That's not a scientific question. And it's this type of thing that it seems to me throws into question much of what both of these writers are doing, even though, in my view, they've had a very positive effect on the whole issue of how we treat animals. Any reactions to this? I'm curious to how you're... Jerry.
I'm confused about when you're saying that he was starting with this assumption, and that was the fact that he started with this assumption sort of undermines his argument. But isn't that assumption something that, like, who disagrees with that assumption? I mean, I don't, maybe I'm missing.
A lot of people, most humans historically have disagreed with it, and some people disagree with it today. But the deeper, the more fundamental question would be, why did they come to assume this in the first place? And they came to assume it because it grew organically out of their larger worldview. There, at least, you can argue that Jews and Christians are giving some reasons for this belief. Singer and Regan give no reasons for the belief. They just assume it to be true. And the only reason they can assume it, apparently, is that it's widely held. But since when do you measure truth on the basis of how widely held the belief is?
Well, it just seems like that would be a more reasonable place to have an assumption, something that's more universally agreed upon than like a religious doctrine.
Why? Why would a religious doctrine be less inherently rational? You see, this is the myth of the modern academy, that religion is based on faith and science and philosophy and so on are based on reason. But that's just silly. People don't function that way.
I can make a case. So if we were trying to agree on something, and I said, let's start with the basic assumption.
Yeah.
And I started on an assumption with something that everybody could agree upon, it seems like that would be a better reasoning. If your goal was to come up with a universal that would be like a more reasonable place to start.
Oh.
Something where you would immediately have this division.
Okay, but then the argument would have to go the other way, because most Americans believe, let's say just Americans, Singer's an Australian, but most Americans believe in God. So, and they believe humans were created in the image of God. So if you're just doing it on the basis of how widespread the belief is, then he loses. Because most people, in this culture at least, believe that humans do have an immortal soul and that they were created in the image of God and thus are more valuable than sentient animals.
But the assumption that he was starting with was not that animals are equal to humans. It was that humans have equal value. Isn't that the assumption that you were...
Yes, that's a basic assumption. But then the way he extends it is because even animals like pigs and so on are smarter than very badly damaged humans. Therefore, we ought to give them equal inherent value. But that's not the way most people view the question of an equal inherent value. They believe that humans have equal inherent value because they are created in the image of God. So even if you're talking about numbers of people, he loses at both points. Shannon?
Yeah. What I was going to say is, if you want an example of, you know, people who believe that humans have equal inherent value, can you
just a little louder, please? Just a little louder, please.
Oh, if you want an example of something, like a major group that believes that humans don't have equal inherent value, like Hinduism with the caste system. Like, I mean, they believe that certain people are less worthy because of something.
Of course. And most people have believed this through the years, and to some extent it's also, in practical ways, had quite an influence in Western culture.
And I think it's really presumptuous also to say that the only people who don't think that religious people would be the only people who think that humans have a special place, because
Well,
there are definitely people who aren't religious who think that.
Of course. It's a belief that is very close to being universal, particularly if you look at how people act. If you look at their operational values. But my interest here is to get you to think about what I consider a very, very deep prejudice in the society, and that is fundamental, I think, to how we look at some environmental issues, is the prejudice against religious belief. There simply, in my view, are no good philosophical reasons why religious belief should be considered less reasonable, less rational than humanistic belief. The contrast is not between religion and science. That's a phony contrast. The contrast is between a religious worldview, say, such as Christianity, and a secular worldview, such as Marxism or perhaps some form of secular humanism and so on. Because Christians and Jews accept science just like humanists do. But to think that the theistic worldview is less rational than the secular worldview, that, it seems to me, just has no strong basis to support it. Now, notice how that works itself out culturally. Let's take a very, very controversial example that's contemporary. Should the Ten Commandments have been posted in the courthouse? If you've watched television recently, I don't watch it, but I assume it's been on television. What was it? Judge Moore was his name, who got booted because he insisted on having the Ten Commandments in the courthouse. Now, I think the state's position here was absolutely wrong, because the state allows in the courthouse, well, actually the Supreme Court has the Ten Commandments and so do many other courts, but the government allows in courthouses sayings by Voltaire, by Aristotle, by all kinds of secular thinkers. Why are they privileged over against, in this case, the Ten Commandments? There's no convincing reason why that should be, unless you are simply discriminating against religious views. The argument that having the Ten Commandments in the state house somehow establishes Judaism or Christianity as the state religion is, I think, just silly. Does that make any sense to you? In other words, we live in a society today that I think is very, very far from where the founders are, that is virulently anti-religious when it comes to the public life. If you want to be religious, do it in private. Just like we said to blacks, you can ride in the bus, but you sit in the back and shut up. Don't make a fuss. You can be religious in America today, but do it quietly. Sit in the back of the bus. Keep quiet. Don't think you have any right to influence the public life. I think this is bizarre. And I think it's going to be the source of unending culture wars until we begin to realize that the whole argument, which is behind Singer and Regan, for instance, that secular reason is somehow rationally privileged, until we realize that that argument is bogus, we're going to have a very constipated, prejudicial, narrow way of doing ethics and of doing politics and of thinking about the public life. Why should only secular people be able to argue their positions in public, but religious people have to shut up and sit in the back of the bus? And that's the way I think these arguments run here. Scott?
Well, I don't know if it's so much that the argument is that secular people, because anyone can think in a secular way.
Okay. Why is that? Because we don't assume that about secular views. Some people are utilitarian, some are Kantian, some are Marxists, and so on. We don't insist that before they can speak in a public meeting, that everyone has to either understand or agree with them. So why would we say that anymore about religious people?
If it's rational, then it's assumed that almost everyone understands why it's rational.
Well, but of course they don't, because take Jeremy Bentham's basic principle that the right is to be determined by what maximizes human happiness. That's a religious, philosophical assumption that you can't prove. It's a kind of what Daryl Bem calls a primitive. So why should that be privileged as over against the Jewish belief that life is a matter of loving God and serving your neighbor? I see no inherent reason other than just religionism, a fundamental bias against religion and religious people, why the one should be acceptable but not the other. Fine, that could be, and that's why religious people ought to be able to speak up, why Cornell ought to have courses in Christian ethics and so on, because people are coming at these issues from different perspectives, and my view is that in a democratic society, you try to find overlapping consensus as the basis for establishing public policy, but you don't find overlapping consensus by disenfranchising most citizens, because most citizens are not then free to say what they really believe. Their real beliefs are rooted in their religious framework, and this is particularly true in America, but they have to be quiet about that. Why? Doesn't this seem very, very odd? In fact, in the material that I didn't finish the other day, this is carried to really extreme lengths by writers like Robert Audi. He argues, this is a paper I haven't published yet, he argues in his writings that, I say, one of the more extreme positions regarding religion and politics is taken by political philosopher Robert Audi, A-U-D-I. His principle of secular rationale states that, quote, one should not advocate or support any law or public policy that restricts human conduct unless one has and is willing to offer adequate secular reason for this advocacy or support. Audi goes even further in his principle of secular motivation, which states that one should not advocate or promote any legal or public policy restrictions on human conduct unless one not only has and is willing to offer, but is also motivated by adequate secular reason, and so on. Well, that's just bizarre. This would have ruled out at one fell sweep Abraham Lincoln and abolition. Martin Luther King would have been off the table. Why would we want such a society? Is it anything but rank prejudice and bigotry to say that because you have this view of life, that life is about loving God and seeking justice and loving your neighbor, that you are off the table, and only if you're an atheist or a humanist that you can speak freely, or only if you espouse those views? This seems preposterous to me. And yet it's what the dominant wisdom on these issues is. I might add a historical note. Professor Isaac Kramnik and Larry Moore, two superbly fine scholars at Cornell, in their book, The Godless Constitution, I think are really off base on this issue, because the Constitution omits God not because most of the founders were non-religious. They weren't, that many of them were Christians, but most of them were religious. Many of them were deists and Unitarians and so on. It's what I would call not an ideological secularism in the Constitution, but a pragmatic secularism. They agreed to have a secular constitution simply because then they wouldn't be arguing with each other about theological differences. And that's a very practical way to do it. But many of you may not realize, I think I may have mentioned in an earlier class, when the Common School was founded, for instance, everybody just assumed you'd teach religion. There wasn't any question at all. Of course the schools teach religion, and it was a form of what they called non-sectarian Protestant Christianity. And of course you teach Protestant Christian morality. This was not even on the table. Nobody argued. The only argument was whether you also allow Catholics the same freedom and Jews and others. And I think we decided that issue wrongly. I'm not in favor of public schools forcing Christianity on a captive audience, especially one form of Christianity. But does this make any sense, the position I'm taking, that why should we make the kind of argument that they make here? It seems to me this is Singer's argument is just an ignorant argument. To argue that he does it by reason but Christians do it by faith is just stupid, because that's clearly not the way they function. If you go to Jewish Theological Seminary or Catholic University or Notre Dame or Princeton Seminary, there's just as much reason as there is at in the Cornell Philosophy Department. Does this, am I, I'm trying to provoke you here a little bit. I don't know if I'm succeeding or not. Scott, you wanted to come back?
I still don't understand why you're saying that it's only people. You're saying that Christian people, like individuals,
yeah,
don't have a say. But that's not it. It's not so much that they themselves don't have a say. It's just that they can't present it in a way that's in any way religious.
Right. You're correct in that. And that's what seems to me very, very bizarre, because you're saying you can participate only if you deny who you really are. You can't be honest. You can't say, this is really what I think is going on and why we should do this. You have to dissimulate. You have to pretend something else. But why should that be? Because when you make a utilitarian argument that that we ought to maximize human happiness, let's say, that is an argument that's a kind of faith commitment. You can't prove rationally that that's true. Kant can't prove rationally that we ought to always act in such a way that the principle that motivates our action can be universalized. I think it's not a bad idea, incidentally, and that is actually quite close to traditional biblical religion. But you can't prove those positions. The Marxist can't prove rationally, even though it's a secular position, that it's correct. Nor can the secular humanist prove this. Do you see the dilemma we're in? The dilemma is that all of these positions rest on certain initial assumptions that are not compellingly rational to every thoughtful, reasonable people. That's what pluralism really is all about. But those who want to exclude the religious, pull the Ten Commandments out of the courthouse, they simply want to use the power of the state to foster their own viewpoints. And I see that as illegitimate. It's just they're doing themselves exactly what they accuse the others of doing. Any last comment? You can tell I'm rather passionately interested in this idea, Rob, because I think it's one of the biggest problems we face in America today, is that increasingly religious Americans are treated as second-class citizens. And yes, one last word.
Mm-hmm. What if it was the other way? What if it was that the Ten Commandments weren't allowed in the courtroom and someone wanted them in? There's just an equal opportunity for someone to be disenfranchised, and you're saying that Christians are being disenfranchised, or Judeo-Christians, because the Ten Commandments are not allowed in the courtroom. But what about Buddhists?
Well, the reason there is fairly straightforward. You absolutely cannot understand our legal system, you cannot understand our culture and who we are as a people without the Ten Commandments and the way it's played itself out. You can understand America today without Buddhism pretty well. So you do the same thing we do with literature and history and so on. We don't offer the same number of courses in Romanian history or Indonesian history as in American history. We don't offer the same number of courses in some other form of literature.
You also don't say that you have to interpret Indonesian literature from American.
Let's come back to this, because I think there is a very good answer to that. Okay, thank you.